The Kathleen Show, shaking things up and grabbing life by the ovaries. Here's your host, mom, wife, writer, filmmaker, entrepreneur, and overall, regular chick, Kathleen Slattery Moscow.
Hello, hello! This is the program where we push back on our lives and health and say hell no to the status quo. It's about shaking things up and rattling some cages so that we can live big and bold and juicy lives. And I'm not going to say up front that today's show is about depression, because I worry that most of you will reach for the dial thinking, well, that doesn't apply to me. Instead, I'll say it's about busting through those dark days that we all have. I'll say today's show is about the causes of our marital problems, our financial problems, our stress, our temper, our wanting to sit down and cry, our inability to focus or concentrate or sleep. And I wonder if any of that rings a bell. I'm not here to say that we're all depressed, because there is a big difference between major depression, where those dark days turn into dark months and even thoughts of death. But depression is a much bigger problem than most of us realize. And it can be a very slippery slope, especially right now with the economy tanking and so much uncertainty. Back in the day when I used to work for pharma and hated my job, you know, sometimes I think that would make a good country western song, like, I used to sell drugs. Wait, no, let me get in the country mode. Wait, here we go. I used to sell drugs, but then I give up my... Oh, my God, I can't... I got to get some twang here. Just a second. I can't even fake being a singer. Okay, so, you know, I used to sell drugs. Wait, give me some... Okay, Sarah, give me a little country. Can you say something country, like twangy?
No, Robert's going
to
do that.
Robert, give me some country. I used to sell drugs and then I gave the job the boot, you know.
I used to sell drugs, but then I gave the job the boot.
Yes, there you go. See, it is a country western song. Oh, okay. So anyway, you know, when I used to work for pharma, I mostly worked in the psychiatric field. I sold antidepressants, anti-anxiety medications, and antipsychotics. And many times the psychiatrists I called on made cocktails of all three of those drugs. And whether you think that's right or wrong, a lot of times doctors' decisions to do that comes down to the simple fact that mental health is much more subjective than physical health. And that makes it much more challenging to treat and to determine success. And there often comes a point in treating an individual who is really suffering when doctors will try anything, because the patient is hurting so much and there is a risk of suicide. So in psychiatry, you get a lot of mixing and matching of drugs. Add a little bit of this to a little bit of that and pray for the best. And the results of whether those drugs are working or not get complicated by the side effects and trying to figure out which drug is doing what in the body and what needs to be tweaked. The bottom line is that it's messy. Sometimes medication can be just what is needed, and other times it clouds the issue and screws things up even more. So having been there and done that in working behind the scenes, I can say without any doubt that the best thing you can do when it comes to your own mental health and people in your family is to know what all your options are. That you understand that, yes, medication is an option, but only one option of many to try. And maybe that it's not always the best first thing to try. And to understand that these medications have both benefits and side effects, and that those should be carefully weighed. And to understand that it is okay to push back and question your doctor. And then to find peace in the fact that weighing those things might mean that medication is right for you. But that doesn't necessarily mean it's right for your neighbor or your coworker or your brother. Things are so much more individual when it comes to the treatment of depression. But here's the cool thing. We now have science specifically demonstrating that what we eat, how often we move our bodies, how often we take a time out, and our sleep patterns can often have the same, if not better, physiological effects on the brain as medication. So lifestyle changes are another option, which just might be the ticket for that next-door neighbor whose brain and circumstances are different from yours. And I recently stumbled across something I had missed in all my years entrenched in this field. And that is the brilliant work of a psychotherapist named Dr. Richard O'Connor, who wrote a groundbreaking book called Undoing Depression. His work offers options that go beyond medication and beyond therapy and even beyond physically taking good care of ourselves. It's about breaking the habits of depression. His work can help get us out and keep us out of major depression and also just those occasional dark days. It's about feeling joy again. This is The Kathleen Show. I'll be right back with Dr. O'Connor after the break.
Feeling stuck in your job, your marriage, your body? Well, you're in the right place. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to The Kathleen Show.
Welcome back. When depression and feeling down has become a way of living, a way of doing life, there are options to consider beyond medication and beyond therapy. My guest today is Dr. Richard O'Connor. He is a practicing psychotherapist with offices in Connecticut and New York City. Dr. O'Connor is the author of one of the most popular books on treating depression called Undoing Depression. Dr. O'Connor, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Kathleen. It's a pleasure to be here.
How common is depression?
Depression is very, very common. Most estimates say that about one in five people will have an episode of depression at some point or other in their lifetimes. And the really bad news about depression is that people are recognizing that it recurs. Chances are 50-50 if you have one episode that you'll have another. But if you have three episodes, you're 90% likely to keep having more. And in between episodes, your life is damaged. You know, you're not the life of the party either.
I mean, these rates have been increasing in the, you know, in the past several decades, haven't they?
Yes, they seem to have been. And it's a worldwide phenomenon, and no one really understands it. I think that, you know, we can point to harsh economic times in the U.S. now for a recent increase. There's been a recent, you know, dramatic sort of uptick. But other than that, the rate has been increasing worldwide, and the World Health Organization is now estimating that depression will soon be the most expensive public health problem there is.
You have a stat in the book that shocked me. You say 15% of all people with major depression will commit suicide.
Yes.
And that suicide is the 10th leading cause of death.
Yeah, suicide is really far too common. It's, you know, I think that occasionally there are people who might feel that suicide is a reasonable option if they're you know, facing a terminal illness or something like that. But far, far, far more suicides are the result of depression. And, you know, the official estimate is that there are about 33,000 suicides a year in the U.S. That's twice as many as the deaths from AIDS, by the way. But suicide and depression are, you know, do not get the attention that they deserve, largely because of our attitudes of stigma and shame. We don't like to talk about these things.
Your book, Undoing Depression, was very personal for you. You know,
both, yes.
You know, both based on your work as a practitioner and your own experience with depression.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Can you share a little bit about that story?
Oh, okay. I think depression is in my blood, so to speak. I think I've had two episodes of what you might call major depression, and one was during college. The history is that my mother committed suicide when I was 15, and I seemed to do fine for a while. But after 3 or 4 years, I became very lonely, very isolated, very gloomy, and started really screwing up in college. You know, it's very difficult to understand why a loved one would commit suicide. And people often blame themselves, or they feel that the loved one's love was not genuine. You know, if she really loved me, how could she do something like that? Eventually, you move on from questions like that. I think that you have to understand that suicides are in such a place, they're so depressed that they feel their life is a burden to others. They feel that people would be better off without them. And, of course, that's a delusion. That's not so. But that's what depression drives you to.
What are some of the warning signals of depression?
I think gloomy thoughts, pessimistic thoughts, thoughts about death, thoughts about getting away from it all somehow, some dramatic change in your life, social withdrawal, not interested in seeing friends, not enjoying the things you used to enjoy, feelings of guilt or shame or self-blame. Activity level slows down. You don't have the energy you used to do. You have trouble concentrating and making decisions. Depression is a complex thing, but it really has some effects on the brain. So we lose the ability to really experience joy. We really have some damage occurring in the areas about concentration. These things can be repaired, but the longer depression goes on untreated, the more difficult it is.
I do want to get to the concept of brain damage in mm-hmm. just a little bit, because I think mm-hmm. that's fascinating. I want to point out one other thing that you mentioned in your book, and that was, and in on your website and stuff, and from a psychotherapist's perspective, you often would see a patient come in for other things. Their marriage is falling
yes.
apart. They lost their job. They can't hold a job. It was all these external things that's why they come in for. And then ultimately what you would find is that really the reason those things are happening is because of their underlying depression. And they
right.
they just did not see it, refused to see it, would not maybe describe themselves in the way you just described, but they were experiencing the ramifications, the fallout in their own life.
Right. People can really not see the nose on their faces. I think one of the primary reasons I wrote the book was that when I ran a mental health clinic, we often saw people and families in crisis, and from their marriages were falling apart, they'd lost their jobs, they'd developed an addiction, they had been hospitalized. I had this strong feeling that if they had gotten help earlier for the underlying depression, their lives would not be so damaged as they were now. We would just be treating a simple depression instead of trying to put a whole family back together. So I wanted to reach out to people before the damage got to be so great.
Let's go into the brain damage a little bit more, because again, mm-hmm. I thought this was just fascinating. So explain the damage that is done by depression and our depressive way of thinking. Mm-hmm. Explain that effect on the chemistry of the brain.
The chemistry and the physical structure of the brain. No one really understands how this comes about, and people sometimes argue about whether depression is a result of brain damage or brain damage is the result of depression. And I think the present state of affairs is that no one really knows. But we do know, for instance, that if you have depression long enough, the receptors in your brain for endorphins, the happy little hormones that are associated with runner's high or with chocolate or with sex, the hormones that give you a feeling of joy, the receptor sites for those hormones just disappear. They wither away. So that, not only when you're depressed, not only does life seem joyless, it actually is joyless, and you do lose the ability to experience the same pleasure you used to do in similar situations. There's other damage to the hippocampus, we know now, which is a central processing point for emotions. It's a point where that we absolutely need in order to see things clearly, to separate out our emotional opinions from our logical opinions, so to speak. The hippocampus sort of synthesizes that so we can make better decisions. But in depression, the hippocampus withers. It can lose up to 20% of its volume. And that means that we really do have trouble concentrating and making decisions. And people with depression often report this and feel that they're to blame somehow. They should be able to just pull themselves up by the bootstraps and start thinking better. But they can't. It can happen. They can get repaired, but it can't happen overnight or by force of will.
Well, and that's what I think is really important to point out. It's very disturbing to learn that actually, you know, feeling down and acting down can rewire our brains, you know,
yes.
and have that damage occur. The
yes.
flip side is the good news is that it is repairable through, you know, specific choices we make. And we're going to get into some of the specific habits in a moment. But, you know, can you explain how the flip side works?
Well, there have been enough studies now to show that both antidepressant medication and psychotherapy can result in repair to the hippocampus, for instance, where the brain regenerates itself. You know, up until we've had a revolution in neuroscience in the past 10 years. 10 years ago, we never knew that the brain developed new cells. Now we know it's constantly developing new cells, and the hippocampus is one area where they're growing.
And I think what was so exciting about what I read, too, in your book and on your website, too, is that it's not only about medication and maybe psychotherapy, but it's also about choosing to put ourselves in joyful situations. Even if we don't
yes.
feel like it, we still can make
right.
that conscious choice to surround ourselves with people we love, to put a smile on our face. I love the whole, you know, you have the whole fake it till you make it thing.
Yes. Yes.
To really put ourselves around the things we love and that bring us joy. And just in being in those situations, some of the rewiring can take place.
Yes, that's exactly so. That's a very, very important principle to remember. You know, AA has this saying of fake it till you make it, and they mean just go to the meetings even if you don't believe it yet. Sometime, somewhere, it'll start to rub off on you. And this seems to be the case with recovery from depression. It's practice that makes perfect. We can't repair ourselves through thinking about it or through talking about it. But if we engage in newer and healthier and more constructive kinds of habits, we will get better.
I want to read a passage from the back cover of the book. Quote, "Depression has been your experience for so long that you've begun to believe it is what you are. Unwittingly, we get good at depression. We learn how to hide it, work around it. We may even achieve great things, but with constant struggle rather than satisfaction." End quote.
Yeah.
What
yeah.
do you mean we get good at depression?
Oh, depression becomes so natural to us that it seems like the normal way to be. You know, we come to feel more comfortable being alone than out with company, for instance. We come to expect less of ourselves. We sort of stop trying to be our best selves and just settle for getting to work, coming home, having a pint of Ben and Jerry's and going to bed, maybe to sleep and maybe not. But, you know, we really settle for less than what we can be. That's part of what I mean by being good at depression.
You know, I've had people close to me suffering with variety of, you know, whether it's depression or anxiety. And and even when the certain physical aspects seem a little bit under control, there seems to be a little bit of sense of loss of, well, now what? You know what I mean? Now something's actually, you know, expected of me. And not, you know what I mean? Like, it's not like the outside world is dumping this pressure on them, but it is this sense of sort of being lost for a while, of figuring out how to wear this new skin. you know, of
yes.
of what to do. Can you share some specific examples? We're only going to have a couple of minutes to start these, but then when we come back from the break, we'll kind of go on. But can you share some specific examples of how we can replace or undo those bad habits that kind of develop over time of just the how do you undo those habits of being depressed that, you know, we can fall back on?
Well, maybe we can start with what I think is the biggest change necessary, and that's developing an attitude of mindfulness. Mindfulness means being fully aware of ourselves and the world and our feelings, but being a little bit detached from them. I think most of us are usually in a mindless state. We're always rushing around, crossing to-do items off our lists. We always feel a little bit rushed and playing catch-up, as if we're behind the ball. Mindfulness means getting into the opposite kind of state, getting on the ball, so to speak. And one of the best ways to learn it is through regular practice of mindfulness meditation, to sit in a quiet place where you won't be disturbed for half an hour and just concentrate on your breathing. And you notice when you try to do this that disturbing and upsetting thoughts and ideas and feelings come into your brain, and the practice is to just let them go and return your attention to your breath. And with enough practice, that becomes a sort of a habit, so that you are not as disturbed by impulses, feelings, distracting thoughts, that kind of thing. And you have a little bit of distance between yourself and the hurry up of life, and you can make better decisions, you can communicate more effectively, you can take care of yourself much better, you can really live according to your best values instead of always being forced around by circumstances.
I'm Kathleen Slattery-Moskow. My guest is Dr. Richard O'Connor. His book is Undoing Depression, and we'll be right back after the break.
Did you ever lie down, stare at the ceiling, and wonder just who you were? Or if your polished owls and crystal...
Who said talk radio had to be all political blowhards and bottomless sports? Hold your knickers, everyone, because there's a new cat in town. Kathleen Slattery, Moscow.
Did you ever lie down, stare at the ceiling, and wonder just who you were?
We're talking about a powerful book called Undoing Depression, What Therapy Doesn't Teach You and Medication Can't Give You. And yes, this is a must read for anyone suffering from depression, but I think it's also an important book for any of us as we wrestle, you know, with dark days or stressful situations. My guest is the author and practicing psychotherapist, Dr. Richard O'Connor. His website is undoingdepression.com. Dr. O'Connor, right before the break, we started to kind of go into, you know, some of the new habits we can learn to kind of undo, you know, the old and just the way we know about how of living under, you know, under the, you know, umbrella of depression. And the first thing you had mentioned was, you know, meditation and being mindful. What are some other really hands-on practical things that people can start applying that can, you know, change these behaviors?
Well, let me say back on the other subject that you don't absolutely have to practice meditation every day to develop an attitude of mindfulness. You can develop it through prayer. You can develop it through walking. You can develop it through just being quiet and listening to yourself. It's really a sort of practice in rising above the noise in your brain. We have been conditioned, I think, to respond too quickly to whatever stress or idea or impulse comes up. And if we can just learn to slow down and think through our decisions more thoughtfully and think through our reactions more carefully and be patient with our emotions, we can end up in a much calmer and more controlled state. And that is good for all of us, but it really helps with depression because people with depression really think that they're losing their minds. You know, they really feel totally out of control. They don't understand what's happening to them. And this doesn't promise overnight recovery, but with enough practice, you do realize that you have better control than what you thought. You are not crazy. There are reasons for your feelings. And you're not a total basket case. You will be fine if you just keep on practicing.
I know some of the other things I think you mentioned was, again, we've mentioned before, making a choice to put yourself in joyful situations or things that you at least you once loved, you know?
Yes. As we said, fake it till you make it. You need to... The impulse with depression is to withdraw, to stay isolated, and to kind of be irritable and cranky and leave me alone. And I think what we have to do is realize that giving into those impulses only makes the depression worse. It only makes it more likely that we'll give into those impulses in the future. But if we get invited out, we should go out. If we don't get invited out, we should find things to do because it really helps us to be around people. It really, really helps to see that not everybody feels as gloomy as you do, that other people have some joy in their lives, and that, you know, maybe you're looking at things a little bit too bleakly yourself.
This is the Kathleen Show. We're up against another break, but I'll be right back with Dr. Richard O'Connor after these messages.
It's the Kathleen Show, pushing back and saying hell no to the status quo. And here's your host, Kathleen Slattery Moscow.
I'll pack up all your things and set your suitcase on fire. You might try to ride in town.
If you think that medication and therapy are your only options for treating depression, think again. We can take charge of certain things that not only change the way we feel each day, but actually change our brain chemistry. This may not be the only answer, but can certainly mean the difference in our recovery or our lack of recovery. My guest is Dr. Richard O'Connor, the author of the book Undoing Depression. This interview is available at Dr. O'Connor's guest page on our website at thekathleenshow.com. I was really fascinated by this topic of being isolated or isolating yourself, you know, because obviously this gets into our relationships with other people.
Yes.
And you had mentioned, I don't know why, I worked in this field for years, unfortunately. Unfortunately, on the pharmaceutical industry side, but, you know, I worked with, you know, depression in psychiatry for a long time. But this never occurred to me that when we're depressed, it's our nature to isolate ourselves and to push people away. And again, it made me think of the people who I've known who struggle with depression. And I can definitely, you know, now see that they have this common trait among them in one way or another.
Yes.
But since isolation can look a variety of different ways, can you give some specific examples, you know, of what this looks like and what someone can do? I know you started to go in this before the break, what someone can do to overcome that urge to just push away.
Okay. Well, I think, like you say, isolation can take many forms. You know, men and women are different from this. Typically, men sort of become grumpy bears who didn't get enough hibernation time, and they tend to be cranky and swat at anything that comes within reach. Women tend to be more self-blaming, more intrapunitive is the word. They tend to think that something is wrong with them, and they feel, and everyone feels ashamed of whatever it is and feels like it's the terrible crime they've committed, or that they're being weak, or that they're being silly, or something like that. And so they keep these feelings from their friends and their family. And that just makes the situation worse, because the more you keep a guilty secret in the dark, the more it grows. You know, secrets grow like mushrooms. We have to drag them out into the light of day, and then they will indeed wither away.
I think your comments too that it, you know, it's twofold. That it's number one that you want to protect those people. You kind of push away to protect those people around you from having to experience what you're experiencing.
Yeah.
But you're
yes.
also doing it because you're embarrassed and ashamed, and you don't really
yes.
want people to know what's really going on. So it's
right.
like this defense mechanism. I'm going to bite
right.
your head off so that you don't. You know what I mean? Because that's easier to deal with. You thinking I'm grumpy than thinking I've got something really wrong with me.
Yeah. But the result is depressed people are very difficult to live with. You know that they're suffering, but they reject all help. All the common sense kinds of things that you would try to do, like to get them to talk about it or to just be kind and attentive, they don't want attention, unfortunately. They feel like attention is going to drag out their weaknesses. I think one of the most devastating and ironic things about depression is this feeling of shame and self-blame and guilt. We blame ourselves for being depressed, and we don't realize that that is a symptom of the disease itself. Self-blame and guilt go with depression hand in hand, and it's just not your fault. It's because something has happened to you. Something has usually people have are vulnerable because of difficult childhood experiences, and then they have a series of stresses in their adult life that are just too much to bear. And you know, if we called it burnout, people would accept it a lot more. But burnout is really the same thing as depression. It just means you've had too much on your plate, and you need to step back and regroup.
Yeah, and I think what you said about knowing that it is not your fault, you shouldn't blame yourself, but then the empowering thought of knowing, but there are some measures I can take.
Yes.
You know what I mean? There are some measures,
yeah.
And we're going to... Okay, we're up against the break again. I'm Kathleen Slattery-Moskow. I'll be right back with my remaining moments with Dr. Richard O'Connor. His website is undoingdepression.com.
The Kathleen Show, rattling some cages and giving life and health a swift kick in the pants. Here's your hostess with the mostest, Kathleen Slattery-Moskow.
I'm heading into the home stretch with Dr. Richard O'Connor, the author of Undoing Depression. And I absolutely want to make sure we touch on medication before we're done here. But there's so much about your work that I just loved. But I read an old New York Times article in which you were quoted as saying that one of the reasons depression may be on the rise is due to, quote, a loss of identity as producers and a new identity as consumers, end quote. And, again, it's sort of off the beaten path a little bit of what we're talking about because we're in the thick of what we can do. But, boy, that struck a chord with me. Can you explain what you meant by that?
Well, I think, you know, a great part of depression is a loss of meaning in our lives. And I personally think that one of the reasons why we're in such an epidemic is that, you know, work has lost its meaning for us. There was just a recent survey that says, you know, more workers are unhappy with their jobs than ever in the survey history. We're not making things anymore. You know, we're not producing products that people can have a little pride of craftsmanship in. We're just providing services. And you know, when you're in a service industry, you have to keep a smile on your face all the time. I mean, if you're milling ball bearings. Nobody cares if you have a cranky day, but if you're working at a hotel desk, you have to paste a smile on your face. And that creates more depression, I believe, whenever we're trying to be something other than how we genuinely feel. We're stressing ourselves out. We're making ourselves feel phony and abnormal and inauthentic.
And it's not the same as what you were talking about before, when we're making a conscious decision to fake it till we make it. That's different than this sort of being put onto us by the outside.
Right. Right. This is a decision that comes from within.
Right. And I think, too, just this whole, in terms of relating it to the consumerism, when we're buying so much stuff all the time and racking up the debt and everything else, then when we go to work, we're just going to work to pay for all this, you know, stuff, this nothingness versus going to work with a purpose that I'm taking care of my family and we're doing good things. And we're instead, it's just to pay down the credit card companies and everything else because of, again, mindless decisions on the back side of things. So,
I just
love that concept. Okay, so can you talk briefly about the role, because I know you discussed the role creativity can play in staving off depression.
Well, I think, you know, depression in a way can be viewed as a loss of creativity. And it's probably, you know, some of the last things that that people with depression recover are the ability to experience joy again and the ability to be creative and be loose in their thinking and allow themselves to just look into the distance and imagine. So it's tough for depression. One of the things I recommend for people is that they look for people to model themselves after. I think, you know, I call it look for heroes. Unfortunately, there are not very many heroes around these days. It seems like everybody gets exposed as some sort of phony or a cheat or, you know, I don't have to go into it.
But there are
people we can really look up to, even if we're just looking at historical figures or religious figures or people whose lives we can model ourselves after. And we can think, you know, how would Lincoln think about this situation? How would Gandhi? How would Martin Luther King?
I love that, and it's so weird that you just brought that up, because literally we just did a show on this kind of seeking heroes even through our reading, you know, choices, and whether it's nonfiction or even fiction, to have someone to aspire to, boy, that can put some wind in your sails.
Yes, it can.
It puts wind in my sails, I'll say.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's quickly, we've got like just a few minutes left. Let's talk about medication. Now, I just want to say that I just want to make sure people understand that although I think we should always ask better questions about the drugs we're taking, there is a time and a place for everything. And depression is certainly nothing to fool around with, and you have to seriously consider all your options. What is your stance on medication?
Actually, I'm very glad medications are around for some of my patients, and I've seen them do... seen meds do marvelous things for people. Unfortunately, though, the minority of people. There was just a study coming out that says that the medications seem to be most effective for those with severe depression and not as effective for those with mild to moderate depression. But those are the people who are getting most of the prescriptions.
The people that are getting the mild to moderate are getting most of the prescriptions, because those are the ones being advertised to on television. And again, you know, I think with depression, there's no messing around. It has to be something that you consider, but also know that when you're making that choice, there's baggage that comes with it. So it's got weighing the pros and the cons. And what I loved about your book is that it really shows it's not the only option. There are other measures you can do in conjunction with or separately first, or, you know, whatever the case is.
No, it's not the only option, but boy, I have to say, if you're having suicidal thoughts, or if you're not sleeping for 4 days, or, you know, if you can't get out of bed in the morning, go see a doctor first.
Oh, boy. I didn't sleep for 2 years. I think I should have got in a lot earlier. Oh, Lord. Okay, Dr. O'Connor, thank you so much for being with me today.
It's been a pleasure, Kathleen.
I really enjoyed your book.
Good. I'm glad to hear that.
That was Dr. Richard O'Connor. His website is undoingdepression.com, and his book, Undoing Depression, is a gem and would be a gift of life for anyone you know who is suffering from the disease. This interview and more links to Dr. O'Connor will be up on his guest page at our website, thekathleenshow.com. Coming up is my pick of the week. Travel by foot, so park your car. And it won't even take long to catch a feeling. Hello, this is Kathleen. It's been so much fun to pull some of these beautiful interviews from our archives. In total, we've selected 50 past interviews to re-release, and we will be recording and posting new episodes as well each week. You can help us out a ton by subscribing to the podcast, and if it's on your heart, please also leave a review and share the episodes you love with everyone you know. And finally, if you are interested in the yoga and meditation aspects of my work, those are the aspects that are instrumental to who I am as a person. If you are interested in yoga and meditation, please check out my online video series, Yoga for Beginners, where I teach you the fundamentals of several key poses in yoga. You will learn step by step what to do and what not to do in each pose, and you will walk away feeling capable about your ability to do yoga. And you are always welcome to come to Madison, Wisconsin and spend some time doing yoga at my studio, which is called The Studio. We offer a full array of daily classes as well as yoga teacher training. The studio really is a breathtaking and life-changing sort of place. Come visit us anytime. Thanks, everyone.